My dear friends, you know, we are worshiping this morning in a building that's pretty old. You know when this building was built? Well, every time you walk around the corner on Palmer and Garfield, you can see the date stone set into the corner. It was designed in 1913. That's when the cornerstone was laid, completed in 1914. So it's 106 years old. What a lot of people don't realize, though, is this is not our original worshiping place for St. Marcus Lutheran Church. In fact, it's not even the second, it's the third of our worship spaces. It replaced a beautiful but much smaller wooden building that was built in 1881. And that, in turn, replaced our original, very humble beginnings in a building that had originally been built as a house. Our members in 1875 bought that house from its owners, our mother church, St. John's, at that time on 4th and Highland in the Deer District. We were born out of the Deer District, kind of an interesting little piece of our history. And it's interesting to me that these three buildings, the house, the wooden church, and the brick church, are each illuminated by a different technology. Thankfully, you and I get to live in the era of electricity. Think of the bazillion ways in which electricity makes your life easier and faster, more interesting, and more fun. The building that we used to worship in starting in 1881, had gas service from the city. It was a new technology back then, and the city was very proud that buildings and streets, what a big deal, the streets were no longer going to be dark. It was the gaslight era. And at the southern end of the Third Ward was a huge synthetic gas plant. Coal was dumped there, and it was gasified. It was a very smelly process. Nobody wanted to live there. It was some of the crummiest housing in the city. So first the poor Irish lived there, and then they got sick of it. And after the fire, they moved out, and then the poor Sicilians moved in. And one of the reasons they hated it was it really smelt bad because of the gas works. But that was pretty wonderful to be able to have illumination in your home. But the technology at our first building, the house, there was no gas service yet in Milwaukee when that house was built, probably right after the Civil War in the late 1860s. Do you know how houses were illuminated back in those days? Probably one of two ways. Candles, which are wax or tallow, cast in a form with a cloth thread running up the middle as a wick. Candles were expensive, though, and to actually create enough light to do anything in the house, you had to burn a bunch of them. And only the rich could really afford to have their homes well lit at night. The poor usually got up at the crack of dawn because they had to make use of their daylight. The other way, the other technology for lighting houses before electricity and before gas was burning oil. And the biggest technology innovation at that time was people had found out that you could render whale blubber and turn it into oil, and that made it made an affordable way for even working people to have some light in their homes at night so they didn't have to stumble around in the darkness. They burned oil. Interestingly enough, our first worship space shared a technology with the ancient people of Israel. And I want to talk to you today about the illumination in God's original house in his tent church. Advent fire number two is the burning of oil, not whale blubber. They didn't have any whales in the Mediterranean, but they did have olives. And they figured out long ago that you could make a very fine grade of olive oil by beating the olives. If you crushed them, then you'd get a lot of debris, and the oil would be kind of cloudy. But if you would just beat them with sticks, the oil would seep out and a very fine grade of olive oil could be obtained. And they found out that it was flammable. And I want to talk to you about the meaning of God's Advent fire as you and I are waiting. We're waiting for Christmas, to be sure. But you know, December 24th and 25th are going to come without you lifting a finger. We're just strapped to the locomotive of time and being shot down the tracks. You don't have to, you can't make it come any faster or slower, but it's coming. When you're a kid, it seems everlasting. It seems like it may just be 20 more days till Christmas, but it might as well seem like 20 more months when you're a kid. But you know, that's not what we're really itching in our waiting for. We're waiting for the end of pandemics. We're waiting for the end of discrimination and racism. We're waiting for the end of looting and street violence. We're waiting for the end of wars and murders. We're waiting for Jesus, just as the Old Testament Israelites were waiting for Jesus too. But the Advent fire helps us wait with confidence. So let's talk about it some more. Last week I talked to you about what the courtyard looked like. The tabernacle that God himself designed and instructed Moses to have his artisans build, God was the architect, and he put the plans in the brains of two tech wizards, two tradespeople who were good at everything and could supervise all this work. Now remember, the people of Israel were huddled in rows around the base of the mountain range where Mount Sinai was, where Moses was receiving all this. Incidentally, while Moses is getting all his instructions, the people of Israel are building a golden calf. It's really pathetic and painful. We won't get into that story today, though, but it's just an illustration that no matter how incredibly God reveals himself, even the believers can take their stupid pills in the morning and completely lose it spiritually. You may resonate with that a little bit, because maybe you've had some terrible breakdowns in your life where you've lost it spiritually, or you with words, deeds, and thoughts, you completely betrayed the faith that you thought you had. But it was for the restoration of such dopes and sinful fools as the Israelites, and you and me, and especially me, chief of sinners. You are all sinners, and I am your chief. It is for that very reason that a Savior was to come. And the tabernacle was built as a visual divine drama to help people get how you could be restored. Even restoration after building a golden calf idol. How pathetic is that? And yet there was restoration available through the work of Christ reaching backwards in time for their need. The tabernacle, first, if you'd have looked at it, first you'd have seen a fence. It was about 50 yards long, like half the length of a football field. So if you'd stand on the goal line, the tent fencing, which was made of poles jammed into the ground with animal hides, skins stretched in between as a screen. And it was 50 yards this way and 25 yards this way. So it was a rectangle. The people were allowed inside there. The whole nation couldn't all fit in at one time. But remember, they didn't really have church services the way we do, where they all went to church. You couldn't have 2 or 3 million people all going to church at the same time. It was more a do-it-yourself worship experience, where the people would come when they had a chance. Perhaps they had a system organized where they could take turns. But if you went into the flaps of that courtyard, you would see three things. You would see the tent itself, which was a rectangle, 15 by 45 feet. Not real big. There are bigger tents at Summerfest. And then you would see two objects standing in the courtyard that you could approach. One was a washstand for the priests. They ceremonially had to keep washing their hands over and over and over as a reminder that they're dirty too, that just because they're priests doesn't make them any better than the other people out there. And their priesthood was not a reward given for achievement. God determined to give it to them by birth as an honor to Aaron, their ancestor. But they needed to keep washing. Just like I told you, mentioned last week, it's like parking downtown. You got to keep feeding the meter with quarters because those quarters don't last. You get, what, 10 minutes. You have to keep feeding the meter with quarters. Well, they had to keep washing their hands over and over. And that washstand was cast out of bronze. Believe it or not, at the foot of Mount Sinai, they had a whole workshop there since they were going to be parked there for many months. They actually had a brass foundry there, which just blows my mind. Some people there had the knowledge of the technology, how to build a bronze foundry. And they found a way to do dyeing of textiles. They had leather processing shops set up. This just blows my mind. These were slaves who had only what they could carry on their backs, and yet God helped them figure out a way to craft an extraordinary tent of meeting, a place where the nation could meet its God. That's the central reason for the existence of this tabernacle. It was where people, sinful people, met God, could be healed of the things that kept them away, given hope, given God's promises, and given encouragement that they had a bright future coming to keep going. And by the way, where did they get all this bronze out in the middle of the desert? The Bible mentions, just as a little aside, you know where they got the bronze for making that washstand? The women who were perhaps part of maybe they were the wives of the Levites, who were like our altar guild, who did a lot of the support and service functions, donated their mirrors. Isn't that an amazing story? They donated their handheld mirrors. See, when they left Egypt, the Egyptians were so eager to get rid of them because of the plagues, as God was like clenching his muscles for plague number 10 and the actual marching out, the Egyptians said, please go. And they gave, we'll bribe you to leave. And they gave them jewels, which is probably where they got them, and gave them their jewelry, where they got the gold for the beautiful implements in the tabernacle. And they probably gave them their hand mirrors. You know, if you polish metal to a very high sheen, you can see a reflection. And so people for many millennia have been using polished metal to get a little bit of a sense of what they look like, to kind of manage their face and their hair. So the altar guild donated their handheld bronze mirrors, and it was smelted down, and it was cast into the form. They actually knew how to do clay casting. This is so amazing to me. They had that technology, and they made the washstand. And last week, I talked to you about the altar of sacrifice. That also you could see, made of bronze. The fires never went out. It always smelled like burning wood, but it always smelled like burning animal meat as well, because of the steady procession of sacrifices. And that was a violent place. There was death at the altar of sacrifice every day, because that was God's central message. You can't come in to my house. Back off. And one time somebody actually touched the Ark of the Covenant, and that person was killed instantly. That's one of the sad messages that sin separates. Ever since Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, Milton called that paradise lost. We've all been wandering and separated from God by our choice. Don't whine about it. We who sin have joined Satan's rebellion. That means, like Adam and Eve, we are unfit for paradise in our current state. So back off. Talk to the hand. You could only go into the courtyard. And the violence of the killings that went on as the divine executioners, the priests killed all the animals. And then the priests lifted up the meat. They'd carve it up and share a meal if it was a sin offering. If it was a dedication offering, they'd burn the whole thing. And the priest would climb up the steps and stand on the ledge and look over the edge and see the flames licking up. And that represents the pit of death. That altar of sacrifice was the pit of judgment, and it was the fires of hell. And they would throw the animal into hell so that the people could be spared. And God taught them over and over again the concept of substitutionary death. It is the central fact of your and my faith as well. Everything in your life, your ability to relate to God, your ability to step into heaven someday when we're finally, when the hand is finally taken away and the mansions of God are open to you and to me, it is because of one reason only, the substitutionary death of Jesus Christ. Never, never, ever forget that and hang on tight to that. It is your greatest treasure. It is the only thing that will matter a hill of beans on the day of your judgment. That's what will keep you out of those flames. The priests would kill the animals, sometimes quickly, sometimes catching the blood in a kosher style. The blood would be smeared on the little corner nubs, the horns of the altar, or poured out. Wheat and the produce that the farmers produced, the first fruits would get burnt up in there. And even the poor people who brought birds would have to watch the priest. If you're a kid, cover your ears now. This is a very stressful thought. The priest would actually take the bird and grab it by the neck and do this. And the people watched. God wanted them to see that violent death because that expresses the purity of his rage and hatred for all evil. But when those sacrifices had been performed, you could not go into the tabernacle, but the priest could, representing you. And since you couldn't go in, a representation was made for the people. God instructed Moses to have his craftsmen make a golden table, and the ovens of the Levites were to bake loaves of bread, 12 of them, a fresh loaf each week. They would bake on Friday, and when the Sabbath began at Friday at 6 p.m., the priests would take in two stacks. They'd make one for each tribe, big round loaves, and they'd put them in two stacks on the golden table, sprinkle a little incense on that golden table to make sure it smelled good. And that was as close as the people could get to God. Their bread represented them. It was called the bread of presence. But to symbolize the fact that God was meeting them there, in that first room, it was called the holy place, rectangular, 15 by 30, across from the bread table was this. Here's what God instructed Moses to do. Make a lampstand of pure gold. Where did they get gold? Where did these ex-slaves get gold? Well, I think I have an idea. The Egyptians gave them jewelry and their treasures to get out. And the Israelites then donated. In fact, they were so eager for this that they oversubscribed their gifts. And the chief craftspeople told Moses, make the people stop. We got too much stuff. So there was plenty. Make it of pure gold and hammer it out, base and shaft. Its flower-like cups, buds, and blossoms shall be of one piece with it. So this is a tricky casting. I'm so in awe. I could not do this. I don't have the knowledge for gold casting. I would have no idea how to do this properly, but somebody there did. It was big. The Jews today still use this. They call it the menorah. And you'll see them popping out now because it's Hanukkah time. And the menorah is the symbol of the relighting of the lamps after the desecration of the temple. So you'll see them popping up in windows of Jewish homes, and you'll see them out in front of synagogues. It's a seven-branched candlestick, or because some rabbis had a tradition that only the temples could have seven branches. The Hanukkah menorah has nine, so you'll see the central post, and then four branches on each side coming off. But it was a floor-standing unit. It wasn't like you'll see in homes, like a shelf unit or put it on a table. This was a great, big, heavy hunk of thing. The gold weighed 75 pounds. This was a heavy thing, and they had to be portable. Solomon's was much bigger when he made it. I'm sure he didn't make it portable. In fact, Solomon, in his temple, when he built the temple in the 900s, he actually built 10 of them. He had 10 lampstands. But in the tabernacle, there was only one. And it was not only expensive, God wanted the best for his house, but it was beautiful. The artwork was gorgeous. Cups, buds, blossoms. It's to be like three cups shaped like almond flowers with buds and blossoms. Almond is the first tree to flower in the spring. It also was the source of wood for Aaron's staff. And remember that Aaron's staff budded one time as a power miracle to demonstrate that he spoke with God's authority. On the lampstand, there are to be four cups shaped like almond flowers with the buds and blossoms. So that's the middle post. The Jews today call that the shamash. And that had a cluster of four. And then each of the other six branches had a cluster of three. So six times three is, let's do a little math. Six times three is 18. And then the central one had four. So 18 plus four is 22. So they'd light them. So this thing threw off a pretty much light. That pretty much lit up that whole 15 by 30 room. You had 22 oil lamps burning. Let's see, what else can we see in here? The buds and branches shall be all of one piece, hammered out of pure gold. So cast it and then hammer it out. I'm just kind of blown away at that. Let's see, the wick trimmers and all the stuff you need. Use a talent of pure gold, 75 pounds. Make it according to the pattern. In the end of Exodus 27, he says, tell Aaron and his sons, they're to keep the lamps burning before the Lord from evening till morning. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the Israelites for generations to come. So they were on all night. In Leviticus chapter 24, there's a little extra instructions. Command the Israelites to bring you clear oil of pressed olives for the light so that the lamps may be kept burning. Aaron is to tend the lamps before the Lord from evening till morning continually. This is to be a lasting ordinance. The lamps on the pure gold lampstand before the Lord must be tended continually. So there probably was a priest or more inside that building all night long. Those lamps were to be tended continually. What's the point of that? The point of that is, this was illuminating the bread of the presence of the 12 tribes. It was to symbolize that God's office was open 24/7. The doctor is in. Our divine God is in. He's open for business all the time. Even while you sleep, he's alert. In fact, not only did those provide illumination, but Scripture says that the lamps of God, the burning fires of God, are a symbol for his eyes. The prophet Zechariah used that image. Zechariah was allowed to peek into heaven, and a man, the angel who's talking, woke him up as he came out of his vision. And the angel asked me, Zechariah, what do you see? And I answered, I see a solid gold lampstand with a bowl at the top and seven lights on it with seven channels to the lights. Two olive trees providing olive oil. These seven are the eyes of the Lord which range throughout the earth. He said to me, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord Almighty. This represents the fact that God was watching over his people even while they slept. And the seven is a bit of an allusion to the sevenfold spirit of the Lord. Seven is God's covenant number of his grace being applied to people and benefiting them. So it's God is on duty all the time, and he wanted to make sure that those lamps never went out. A little reminder, not so much of what you are doing for God, although the worshipful heart of the priests and Levites and the people who couldn't see that stuff, but they were told what was in there, they knew what was going on in there, could take comfort from the fact that their God was on duty. So what? More of Pastor Mark's, the historic nerd's, old stories of long ago. What does that have to do with me grinding out an existence, wearing my stupid mask, unable to touch and hug people I love, have to stay away even from my family, wrecking my business, making my life such a nuisance, making people sick, going into quarantine and having to disrupt my life, and I could go on and on and on. We've all got plenty of sad songs and sad stories about a world disrupted by COVID. You know, COVID's the least of our problems. Our world's been disrupted ever since Adam and Eve thought it would be much more enjoyable a life to be free from God and found out to their terror and to their shame that life without God is broken, nasty, and short. The tabernacle, the tent, was a little bit of heaven. Inside there, it was peaceful and quiet. Inside there, it smelled good because of that incense on the bread table and the smell of freshly baked bread. What could be better than that? And 12 freshly baked loaves is even more aromatic than one. Inside there, it was illuminated. The camp was dark. The Israelites did not have electricity. They were camping. It got dark and they went to bed, but the lights were on. Maybe you could even see a little bit of glow through the animal skins. And it was a little reminder that God is on duty watching over them. God is on duty watching over us. And I think it's one of the reasons why we have Advent fire in our churches too. That second fire of the fire on the lamps signifies God's eyes and power caring for his people, cherishing his relationship with you and me. And maybe that's the reason why Christians always have been crazy about having candles in the churches. We have Advent fire too. And these candles burning here are not just for artistic effect. They're sending you a quiet little message that God is open for business. And when you come here, and this is as close as we can get, because of sin, we also are kept from a personal, in-person experience of relating with God, just like the way Adam and Eve were driven out, just like the Israelites. But these are little signs of the presence of God and the supper of the Lord, which we are privileged to receive over and over again, shows that God is here. This is how he's showing up. This building is our tent of meeting right now. Here's how you and I connect with our God. And the lights on are just a little reminder that the sevenfold Spirit of the Lord is here, bringing good things to us and listening to our messages and receiving our worship back. His word, the Israelite people, at least at first, had no Bibles. The tabernacle was how they would interact with God. But you and I also have a tent of meeting in the Word. And through the Word, our Lord comes close to us. We can hear him speak to us. And through his promises, he hears us speak to him. The tabernacle was built to help the Israelites wait. And the Advent fire that you see before you today, a little reminder that soon, the time of COVID will be over. The time of racism, warfare, violence, crime, broken families, bitterness, old grudges, resentments, economic struggle, starvation, and suffering, physical suffering and death, that time will be over. God has given us many blessings, but should never give us so much that we choose like Lot's wife. We'd rather live in this brokenness than lift up our eyes. Let all of the pain in your life right now, all the things that are broken in your life, all the things you hate, all the things that cause you pain, look at the burning up here of the lights and just see God keeps his promises. He is here. His Spirit's eyes are on me. I'm not lost. He hasn't lost track of me. He has complete inventory control over every one of his children. And when he chooses, at a time of his choosing, He's going to return, and we will worship from afar no longer. But we shall see him as he is, says St. John, because we will be made like him. May this Advent fire give you hope in your struggle, in your service, and in your waiting.
This message was a production of St. Marcus Lutheran Church. For similar content, subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or our YouTube channel. For more information about how to support our urban gospel ministry in Milwaukee, please visit stmarcus.org.